The business stories today have a common thread around trust and verification. Specifically, who gets to determine what's true in markets where information asymmetry is large? Let's start with Polymarket, because the Wall Street Journal investigation is significant.
Polymarket, for listeners unfamiliar, is a prediction market platform where users bet on the outcomes of real-world events, elections, geopolitical developments, economic indicators. The premise of prediction markets is that aggregating individual beliefs through financial incentives produces more accurate forecasts than polling or expert opinion. There's genuine academic support for this under the right conditions. Polymarket has grown substantially and has been used as a reference for forecasting during major events.
The WSJ investigation found that Polymarket has been paying social media creators to post content promoting the platform without requiring disclosure of the paid relationship. The post scored 348 points and 263 comments, which reflects how seriously the HN community is taking this. The problem is structural. If Polymarket's markets are being promoted through undisclosed paid content, then the market participants are making decisions based on a distorted information environment. The information asymmetry isn't just between bettors, it's being actively manufactured.
There's also a regulatory dimension here that Marcus is well positioned to address. Prediction markets in the US have had a complicated legal history. Polymarket initially operated with US-based users before restricting access to American customers following regulatory pressure. The FTC has authority over deceptive advertising, and the SEC has been watching prediction markets closely. Paying creators without disclosure requirements isn't just ethically questionable. Depending on the specifics, it could implicate securities regulations if the markets are treated as financial instruments.
The crypto story connects to this. Stephen Diel, who has been a consistent and technically credible critic of cryptocurrency, has published a 2026 retrospective titled Crypto in 2026, Oh, This is the Bad Place. The post scored 88 points and 64 comments. Diel's argument is that the current state of crypto has achieved a kind of dystopian stability. The scams and fraud haven't ended, but they've been normalized. Regulatory capture has been partially successful. The promised utility, censorship-resistant payments, financial inclusion, programmable money, remains marginal, while the speculative and fraudulent use cases are dominant.
The HN comments are interesting because they're not uniformly agreeing with Diel, which they might have in 2022 after the FTX collapse. There's a contingent arguing that some legitimate infrastructure has been built, that stablecoins have real use cases in cross-border payments for people without access to traditional banking, and that writing off the entire space because of the dominant use cases is throwing out infrastructure along with the exploitation. It's a more nuanced debate than it was a few years ago.
Canada's nuclear renaissance is a significant policy story that deserves more attention than it typically gets in tech circles. The federal government has announced plans for up to 10 new reactors to be built by 2040, with a combination of large conventional reactors and small modular reactors. It scored 499 points and 343 comments, the second highest engagement of the day after Steam Machine. The energy policy context is important here.
Canada has a combination of factors that make nuclear particularly attractive. It has abundant uranium deposits, existing nuclear expertise from its CANDU reactor program, a power grid that's already substantially clean but faces increasing demand from electrification and AI data centers, and a federal government that has made climate commitments that require clean baseload power. The 10-reactor target by 2040 is ambitious. Canadian nuclear projects have historically faced cost overruns and delays, but the political will appears genuine.
The small modular reactor component is particularly interesting. SMRs are smaller, factory-fabricated reactors that are supposed to be cheaper and faster to deploy than traditional large nuclear plants. Several designs are in various stages of regulatory approval. The bet Canada is making is that SMR technology will be commercially proven in time to contribute meaningfully to the 2040 target. That's a technology readiness assumption worth watching carefully.
This is actually a good point. To do a brief explainer on something that's been in the background of several stories today, antitrust law, because it's relevant to both the prediction market regulation discussion and the broader tech monopoly landscape we've been touching on.
Yes, and we've been referencing regulatory implications without actually explaining the framework. The basic structure in the U.S. comes from the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, which has two main provisions. Section 1 prohibits agreements that unreasonably restrain trade, price-fixing cartels, market allocation between competitors, that kind of thing. Section 2 prohibits monopolization and attempted monopolization.
The crucial nuance that gets lost in most casual discussions is that having a monopoly isn't illegal by itself. What's illegal under Section 2 is acquiring or maintaining a monopoly through exclusionary conduct, behavior that harms competition, rather than just winning on the merits. A company can have 90% market share if it got there by being genuinely better than competitors. The legal question is how it got there and how it's maintaining that position.
A useful analogy. Imagine a town with one great bakery that's put all the other bakeries out of business simply by making better bread at lower prices. That's fine under Sherman. But if that bakery has exclusive agreements with all the flour suppliers that prevent competitors from getting ingredients, or if it's pricing below cost specifically to destroy a new entrant and then plans to raise prices, that's where antitrust law activates. The behavior, not the market share, is what matters.
Market share is still relevant as evidence. Courts look at it to determine whether a company has the market power to actually harm competition. But the Department of Justice and FTC have to show both that market power exists and that it's being used in anti-competitive ways. This is why antitrust cases take years. The Microsoft case in the late 1990s is a good example. The government didn't argue Microsoft was bad for having Windows on most PCs. They argued Microsoft used that position to illegally foreclose Netscape and Java from the market.
Now, the what if we're wrong question for today. The story we've been most confident about in this episode, and frankly, the story the broader tech community seems most confident about, is the efficiency frontier argument. That small models are getting good enough, fast enough, that the advantage of massive frontier models will erode rapidly.
That's the claim. VibeThinker at 3 billion parameters challenging Opus 4.5, Mobius at 200 million parameters matching 10 billion parameter models for inpainting, GLM 5.2 running locally on consumer hardware. The narrative is compelling. Smaller, cheaper, faster, and nearly as good.
So what would need to be true for this narrative to be wrong? The strongest counterargument is that the capability gains from small models are real, but highly task-specific. Benchmarks reward well-defined tasks with clear evaluation criteria. Real-world deployments require general capability, understanding context, handling edge cases, reasoning across domains, maintaining coherence over long interactions. The argument is that there's a capability floor for general utility that smaller models can't reach, and the benchmarks are measuring the wrong thing.
There's also the training compute argument. The efficiency gains we're seeing in small models may be downstream of the frontier models. The synthetic training data, the distillation techniques, the alignment methods were all developed by large-scale training runs. If you stop investing in frontier models, you might stop generating the insights that make small model efficiency possible. The frontier and the efficiency tier may be more codependent than the current narrative suggests.
And if that's true, we'd expect to see a divergence between benchmark performance and real-world deployment satisfaction. The signal to watch is enterprise adoption patterns, specifically, whether companies that try to replace frontier model deployments with smaller models for general-purpose tasks report genuine parity or discover capability gaps under production load. Enterprise support tickets and deployment rollbacks are a leading indicator that would arrive before any academic correction.
The six-month window is probably the right horizon. If by the end of 2026 we're seeing widespread reports of successful frontier to small model migration in general purpose applications, the efficiency narrative is validated. If we're seeing more, "we tried the small model but had to go back" stories, the task specificity concern is real.